WWOZ's on a stereo. String of flowers halo round your head. Candlelight, the ceiling fan. Curtain bows away and back again. Back again.
Hello and welcome to the Outrider Podcast. This is Jason Quinn Malott. And today's guest is Elise Blackwell for interview number 33, I think it is. Yes, it is. Interview number 33. And of course, Elise is the author of the new novel, The Lower Quarter, out from Unbridled Books. And I guess you can hear the cat there in the background. She's very demanding tonight, and so we're going to keep the introduction and this pre-conversation ramble, my monologue, if you will, short, because every time I open my mouth, the cat says, "Why aren't you paying attention to me?" Me, that's what she says. So I'm going to go pay attention to the cat, and you guys are going to pay attention to this conversation I had with Elise Blackwell. It was a lot of fun. I had a great time with it, and I think you'll enjoy it as well. There is a bit of a glitch around the 50-minute mark. Skype decided to cut her out on me, so there'll be a little silence and a reboot there, but not a big deal. It was easier to leave it in than to try and cut it out, because it was so short and so fast that it kind of served as its own transition. That makes sense. You hear that? I'd better go. Otherwise, she's going to start pawing at me because she demands my attention. But that's what you have when you have a cat who's a princess. At least she thinks she is. So let's get right to the conversation with Elise and have a good time. I'll see you in a while. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Have you had a chance to hear any of the previous episodes before? Do you have any questions for me right away about the show?
No, I think I have a good sense of what you're doing.
Okay, cool. Well, let's
when we're done, I have some questions, for you about your writing, and I really enjoyed the query lines that you put together as poems.
Well, thank you.
But we can do that after.
Well, it should be obvious that I don't do a whole lot of research, and although I did read that essay you had on necessary fiction recent that came out lately, and I was poking around on your website and had to stop because it was when I stumbled onto that essay about whether or not you were, or the interview about whether or not you were a Southern writer. And of course, so, the bios and everything. So you're originally from Louisiana, somewhere around in there, correct?
I am. I grew up mostly in Southern Louisiana. So
whereabouts?
And mostly Baton Rouge.
Okay.
And then I have relatives strewn across Southern Louisiana, from New Orleans to Lafayette to Abbeville. So
I had a friend in graduate school who was from New Orleans. Unfortunately, he died young of a heart attack a few years after graduate school. It was unfortunate. He was a very good poet. But that's about the extent of my connections to Louisiana.
What was his name?
Ryan Chigazola.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I kind of lost track from him for a little bit after graduate school, and then all of a sudden someone popped on Facebook and said that he had died, and I was like, well, shit.
Yeah.
So what did your family do down there? How did your family end up in Louisiana? Because I understand that can sometimes be an interesting story.
Yeah, sure. Well, half my family is from Louisiana and half is from Mississippi. So some of my Southern literary credentials come from the Mississippi side. I was lucky enough as a little kid to meet Eudora Welty and Barry Hannah. And Faulkner once set his dogs on my grandfather when he pilgrimaged up there to meet the great man. Set his dogs on him, and then the next day he received them. And my grandmother there was an English professor at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi, and she was full of great stories, including one about picking Ralph Ellison up at the airport and getting in a car wreck with him on the way to his reading. He was fine. The other side of my family, half of them have been in Louisiana since, you know, they crawled across the Atlantic Ocean way back when. And the other half, my grandmother's family, arrived during the Civil War from France set up a shop in New Orleans selling sugar, among other things. I've always wondered if they were war profiteers, because they do seem to have arrived during the Civil War and were, you know, selling a product and that's often rationed during the war. But I don't know. But they stayed, and many of the sort of French members of the family married into the local French population. So my direct family isn't Cajun, but I have lots and lots of in-laws who are. And then they settled, and then my grandmother's father moved the family to a small town called Abbeville, was a French-speaking town, and so the family sort of originated out of there. They still seem to go back and forth from France a lot for the first few decades they were over here. So I'm not sure. And then my grandmother also used to always like to tell the story that we once owned the property where Jack's Brewery is now, and that some in-law absconded with all the money, explaining how that could be true and yet the family not be wealthy. But I don't know. Like, I think family stories in the South are as likely to be exaggerated as not. So I'm never sure. But the good thing is that you grow up in a family and you never know if the stories are true or not, but they're always interesting.
And probably abundant.
Abundant, yeah. It seems like almost everybody's a storyteller.
So that's where it came from, I think, right?
I don't know, maybe. And I don't write autobiographical fiction or family stories, but right. I sometimes think if I ever sort of run out of material that interests me, I could go back there.
I'm always fascinated by that, because my family was not, you know, a really big storytelling family. There's maybe two or three stories that my dad used to tell that I can remember. And his father was quite closed-mouthed about things. And there was a lot of about him that I didn't know until he died, and they mentioned it at his funeral. He apparently was a road kid during the Depression and hopped around on freight trains and you know, worked for a boxing promoter in Los Angeles and some other weird stuff like that. You know, herded sheep in Montana.
He must have had great stories that he just kept to himself.
Just never told them to me, anyway. So I think sometimes that's part of, you know, why that and my uncle who told tall stories, you know, are part of the reason I ended up becoming a writer. But or it could also be that
in Kansas.
Unfortunately, so yeah. So you said your mother was an English professor, or was that your grandmother?
My grandmother. Both my parents are scientists. They're biologists, and I think which helped me come to the material for my first novel, Hunger, which is set during the Siege of Leningrad, but is based on a true story about a group of botanists who lived during that time.
I will have to pick that one up. That's one that I haven't read yet. I've got Cypress Parish, Unfinished Score, and I'm in the middle of reading The Lower Quarter. But my reading habits are so erratic these days.
Yeah, mine come and go. I seem to read like a whole lot at certain times of the year. And then particularly when I'm teaching, a lot of my reading is student fiction and not a whole lot else.
So when did you start actually writing? What was the, did you first realize it was something you were going to be doing?
Oh, my story is probably one you've heard before, and that I knew from a very young age that I wanted to write. I guess I was about 5 when I started writing stories. You know, they used to have those pieces of paper where the top half is blank for a picture and the bottom half is lined for a little story. Like they give it to you in kindergarten or first grade. And so I would fill those up. And there were a few stretches of my life where I thought I might do something else. And dabbled, like when I was 10, I was briefly fascinated with archaeology. And I studied science and math a little bit in college here and there, but I always ran back to the English department pretty fast. So
more out of comfort or fear?
I think out of comfort or just a return to what I sort of always knew that I wanted to do.
Right.
And I think it was actually my writing that fueled the other interests, wanting to find out about stuff and bring news of the world back to my writing. Mm-hmm. And so I know it's a common story. You hear it over and over. So many people who write, with many wonderful exceptions, but so many people who write, I think, came to it very young.
Yeah,
it was an early affliction and lifelong.
It's, in some ways, I think it kind of supports this hypothesis I came across in a book, I think it was called The Midnight Disease or something like that, where they were talking about how writers have similar lesions on their temporal lobes to temporal lobe epileptics who have one of the traits of temporal epileptics, of course, is this, you know, constant need to write, to scribble, to do whatever. And writers have not as bad of lesions, but similar lesions as temporal lobe epileptics.
Wow, that's fascinating. I hadn't seen that research, but it would explain a few things.
That kind of drive to write. Mine started off as pathological lying. You know, I was getting a tiger for my birthday in kindergarten. you know, things like that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and I know. And I think, too, and I told a few tall tales as a child as well. And I think part of that is this that desire to make life more interesting than it is, and to entertain others, right? Like, if I tell you what I'm really getting for my birthday, who cares? But if you think I'm getting a tiger, you're going to be interested.
Fascinated, yes. It kind of flies into the face of no longer at this age anyway, wanting to be the center of attention. But apparently when you tell those stories at 5, you become the center of attention.
So. Yeah. And then I think as you write, you know, you deflect it. And so you lay all of that imagination over the life of a fictional character rather than yourself. Mm-hmm. And so you actually become very much on the periphery of attention in a wonderful way while still indulging all of the imagination in the story.
Do you remember the earliest? Complete without illustrations story that you ever wrote?
No, I don't think I can. My grandfather used to tell us his stories about a fictional monkey that he created. Some of my first stories were fan fiction of my grandfather's bedtime stories. But I do remember I wrote this terrible, terrible story when I was in 7th grade or so called The Meal. And a man sits down and he eats an elaborate meal. And I was very pleased with myself because I knew what camembert cheese was and what kind of sherry you drink after dinner. And
right.
So he eats this entire meal. And then the reader is supposed to realize, you know, at the last sentence of the story that it's his last meal because he's poisoned his own food with arsenic. And so it was, you know, a terrible, terrible story, but I was quite, quite pleased with it. And it was called The Meal. And that's the first story I remember that was unillustrated. and what I wrote. And then it got better.
So. Yeah. If we're all lucky, that happens to us.
Yeah. You're just right your way out of the bad endings. Yep. Young, hopefully.
Yeah, get them out of the way early. Yeah, get that million words or that miles of writing that's horrible under the wheels and behind you. Oh, my goodness. Now,
do you remember your first story?
Oh, my. Well, there's actually two. I don't really remember writing the first one, but for some reason, my mother kept a hold of it. And it was one of those, you know, draw a picture thing, write a short story. And it was probably from around third grade where it was about a dinosaur, and I was going to have a pet dinosaur. I always imagined having pets.
To go with your tiger.
Right. But then in the sixth grade, my teacher, Connie Job, used to do these worksheets on Art Fridays. And they were exercise worksheets for writing fiction and talking about fiction and how fiction is built. And I took off with those. And so my earliest story that I remember was I was into writing a series. It was called The Adventures of Jason and Friends, and it starred all my friends from school. And in this one, we built a time machine and went back to ancient Egypt.
Oh, that's great.
And so, yeah, it developed some bad habits of thinking of writing as a competition. There was this other kid in class who often got his story read, and I was out to get mine read just as often.
Yeah, and I think most writers know that that kind of comparison is not the road to mental health and the brutal business that is publishing.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Did you run off right away in college and major in English, or was this when you were bouncing around with the different sciences?
I did. I started in English and finished in English, and I took a few semesters in other departments here and there, but always went back and kind of went straight through, got a degree in creative writing, and then went to graduate school a year in one MFA program, and then transferred to University of California, Irvine, where I got my MFA. And then I had a long stint of time out of school and out of academia, cobbling together a living, doing various kinds of writing, editing, and translating, sort of whatever I could get a hold of. I worked for a newspaper in San Diego for a while. I was their restaurant reviewer, is how I started. And then and here comes the pathological lying again, because I got bored writing restaurant reviews. It sounds like a great job. You eat for free and they wine you and dine you.
Right.
But it gets really boring after a while to write about food. There are not many words for smell or aroma.
Right.
And the restaurants generally don't like it if you use the word odor. And so I started writing reviews of restaurants that didn't exist, sort of as a way to satirize dining trends.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote a series of reviews of restaurants that didn't exist that were fictional.
Oh, no.
And then got permission from my editor to write about food and agriculture in a kind of a larger way than just the reviews. But so I think I was drawn, even when I was doing journalism, I was trying to write fiction.
Right.
But,
who were some of your earliest creative writing instructors or mentors?
Sure. I had a great teacher at Louisiana State University named Patricia Geary, Pat Geary. I think she's now at Redlands University in California.
Okay.
But Pat really noticed me and encouraged me. Also, when I blew off several weeks of class, I was a bit of a slacker as an undergraduate. She came and found me and gave me a clean slate and a chance to come back to class. And so I've always thanked her. I really don't know how my life would have turned out if she hadn't done that.
Right.
And she is the one who encouraged me to apply to UC Irvine, because that's where she had got her MFA. So she was a great influence on me, and there were several wonderful creative writing teachers at LSU, and I studied a lot with the poets. I never myself was a good poet or drawn to be a poet more than as a practice, but I think the study of poetry really helped my early work. And then I studied for a year in New Mexico.
I can see it in your prose.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's given me appreciation for, you know, diction, you know, just always searching for the right word choice, and also probably a propensity to write in a fairly distilled style, not with every book, but usually. I think especially with my first novel, Hunger. And then I studied for a year at University of New Mexico with a really fabulous Native American writer named Lewis Owens.
Lewis Owens.
Okay. And we happened to share a birthday. And for that reason, I think we stayed in touch across life, maybe longer than we would have otherwise,
because
we would be think of each other and write, you know, give a call or an email or a postcard for the shared birthday.
Right.
He was a very kind of big influence on me early and sadly died some years ago.
Oh.
And then at Irvine, I studied with McDonald Harris, whose real name is Don Heine, but he wrote under McDonald Harris in the Great Oakley Hall. And so they were my primary direct teaching influences. And I think, you know, like a lot of writers, we learn as much from who we read as who we study with.
That was who I was going to ask you about next. Who are the writers in your pantheon?
Early on, I was heavily exposed to Southern literature, and I'm a huge fan of Miss Welty. I also read a lot of Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, Barry Hannah, Faulkner, of course. My grandmother also exposed me to mythology very early on, so I read a lot of Greek and Roman mythology as a child. And then, as a more grown-up writer, I think my influences tend to be fairly poetic fiction writers. So Michael Landace was a huge influence on me, especially in my first book. Andrea Barrett, John Edgar Wideman, and a few others.
Yeah. I guess this might sound a little aggressive at first, but what's the deal with Southern writers? Why is that such a thing, do you think?
I don't know. And it's interesting. I read a really interesting interview with Percival Everett in Virginia Quarterly Review recently, where he basically considers the moniker of Southern writer as vacuous. Like, there's really no such thing. It's a false identification to say that these people of this particular region have a particular style or set of concerns.
Right.
And part of me is sympathetic to that because there's, you know, a great variety of Southern writers, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it is a region of storytelling, and it is a region obsessed with its own relationship to history.
Right.
And, you know, Faulkner's famous quote, the past isn't over. Of course it escapes me while I'm being interviewed. Basically, the past isn't the past, you know,
right.
The past is still the present. And so I think because of that, certain sets of concerns do come up over and over. It's also a region that was on the wrong side of history, and losing sight of a war. And I think that has really fed the literary culture.
I think that might be really the only solid way sometimes to define it, is that you in the South, because there was a for a long time this rigid class structure created by slavery that has really lent itself to that kind of European style of Gothic, you know, which is kind of, I think, very fertile ground for just, you know, very dramatic, very emotional stories that you wouldn't normally associate with newer, more industrial environs.
Yeah, and I guess there's that to the sense of the grotesque that I also think is related to the history and possibly also the weather. it's created. And so it was kind of my new book to, I do play with some of the Gothic elements. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's more of a literary noir. And so a lot of its influence is more out of Los Angeles novels than anything mm-hmm. else. But I think New Orleans is a city that also lends itself to both noir and the grotesque.
Right.
Because of its history, because of its culture, because of the supernatural elements of its stories.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. So how did you leap? What was the moment when you made the leap from, you know, Faulkner and Welty to, you know, people like Ondaatje?
Yeah, well, I grew up on the Southern writers. That's what was given to me by my grandmother and by others. The literature my teachers gave me or referred me to. But I just discovered the others on my own. Ondaatje, particularly his early novels, mm-hmm. Where he was moving from poetry into fiction. So yeah. In The Skin of the Lion and the collected works of Billy the Kid, and especially Coming to Slaughter, just really just blew me away. Mm-hmm. And wow, people can write like this. and I found them very powerful, both in terms of their subject matter and their structure and their form. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, just the beautiful poetic language, the disco quality of his images. So I started reading that on my own. But I was still writing pretty heavily under the influence of some Southern writers.
Right.
When I got to the University of Irvine, one of my very first workshops, the professor threw my story, or was a novel chapter, down on the table and said, "This is neo-Faulknerian crap, and it's not why we let you in here." And I looked around the table at all of my supposed new friends, you know, who are all studying their hands and trying not to make eye contact.
Right, right.
And it took everything I had, you know, not to cry in public. I waited till I got home, and then I cried. But the thing is he was right. What I was writing was turgid, and it was also, I think, inappropriate to the time I was living in. It was Faulknerian, I would say, in content as well as style.
Mm-hmm.
It was imitative. And so I put it down and started to write other kinds of things. And mm-hmm. I think it's any coincidence that my first published novel is about as far away from the Southern United States as you can get. It's set in Leningrad, very cold. And the book is very spare. The sentences are mostly very short. And I think that was sort of a reaction against that, but also an effort to find my own voice.
Right. Right.
And to find a more contemporary voice. So even though that book is set in the past, I think the voice of it is contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed me to go back to some of my Louisiana material and write The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish, which is set in 1927 Louisiana, and draws in a little bit on my grandfather's unpublished memoirs of growing up in rural Louisiana in the 20s.
Okay.
And write that in a way that's not imitative of Faulkner.
Right.
I would hope.
So was it a conscious decision to never write autobiographically, or it just did it happen that way?
It happened that way. I think I was avoiding it, perhaps for subconscious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I do certain things you don't want to write about because they're painful. Other things you don't want to write about yourself because you're just not that interesting. You know, the people I can make up are more interesting than I have. I've certainly had interesting things happen to me in my life, but my life hasn't been unusual, or I would certainly never write a memoir.
Right.
Nothing has happened to me to be memoir worthy. But then as time grew on, I think it became a more conscious decision. So occasionally some hilarious family happening occurs. Like my grandmother was almost buried without her skirt. and I think if I was another kind of Southern writer, you know, who was a kind of a sassy, humorous Southern stories, that would have found its way into my fiction. But it's really not what I write or are interested in exploring. And so I think over time it did become a conscious decision. I've written a very few, like less than a handful of personal essays when I felt particularly moved to write about something. But I think I really think about the world in terms of fiction, and I tended to be more interested in people who are not me than people who are like me.
It's that exercise in extending your empathy that I find most interesting. I think people have explained it as a, you know, you could write what you know, or you could write about what you want to know, or something like that. And so I do it too. I pick a topic that is a little bit removed from me, something out there that I want to see if I can extend myself into and accurately recreate and experience and get it right.
Yeah, me too. And I think there are a few things that work in that. One is just the desire to live other lives vicariously, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
We only get to live the one life, but if you're a fiction writer, you get to at least for certain periods of time live other lives as well, and they can become quite vivid. But I also agree that it is an exercise in empathy, and it's one reason I love to have students who may not be interested in writing ever again try their hand in a creative writing class, because I do think it teaches that just idea of trying to put yourself so fully into another's shoes for a period of time, even if it's a fictional person, is an exercise in empathy that's, I think, really good for our society, for people to try. And then I also think it's a way for us as writers to stay interested in our work too. Usually when I finish a novel, I'm really excited to move on to something completely different, and learn about something new.
On Dache. I'm always surprised to find people that are, I don't know why it is, but I'm always surprised to find people that are fans of Ondaatje, because I never really heard anything about him until I went to graduate school. And, you know, I majored in English. I decided right on the first day to go into creative writing and stuck with it for 5 years. And I took 5 years because I drank a lot. And
yeah, that'll slow you down.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do? And, you know, at that time, I was very keyed into the modernists, who I really didn't become a fan of until I got to college, because they were taught badly when I was in high school. And so I walked out of high school, you know, like Hemingway, Faulkner, oh, forget these guys. They're not that important. Let's go read some science fiction and adventure. And you know, I think one of the when the modernists finally got taught to me effectively, and I got hooked on them, that was kind of where I went. And so I started off with a lot of autobiographical fiction in my workshops. My first novel it's buried somewhere. I've got it in a box. It's never coming out. Was a semi autobiographical novel, and it was terrible. But then I went off to Naropa, and Michael Ondaatje was there my first summer. He came in to do a panel with Bob Creeley and Robin Blazer. It's like one of my favorite stories to tell.
Love to have been there for that.
if you hunt around on the Naropa website and find their audio archive, everything they did over the summer was recorded. And I can hunt down the link and maybe send it to you. But you can hear that panel discussion with Ondaatje and Creeley and Blazer. It's
I'm going to listen to that.
And that was kind of the moment where, you know, the whole light got turned on to Ondaatje. And it turned out that my advisor and primary instructor through my 2 years at Naropa was Bobby Louise Hawkins, who was Bob Creeley's ex-wife and good friends with Michael Ondaatje. And so I was like, hey, and I just sucked up everything. And that was kind of the thing that made me stop writing about myself.
Wow. I didn't realize we had that connection. And it's funny, Michael Ondaatje, you know, and I can't even tell you quite how I came across him. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who had a book of his poetry, but I'm not sure. I think I just saw one of his books in the bookstore and was drawn to it for some reason and started reading it. I don't remember it being formally introduced to me, but I loved it. And then years later, in 2003, my first novel, which was influenced by Ondaatje, was out on submission, but I was waiting to hear back. I went to hear Michael Ondaatje read at I was living in Princeton at the time, working as a copy editor or copywriter. I was writing flap copy.
Right.
And I went to hear him read, and I went up afterward to have my book signed, and I started to approach him, and he looked at me, and I was so nervous, I just left. I didn't get my book signed. And then years later, still, and then I remember I went out that night, and I got a fortune cookie that said, "You're almost there." And I was like, what does that mean? Will my book be published or not? And so I always associate being unable to talk to Michael with that moment of suspension, waiting to find out if my book would be published or not. And then years later, he came to give a reading where I was teaching at University of South Carolina. And I got to, I picked him up at the airport and I took him out to lunch. And, you know, he's a delightful human being.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, now I've made it.
Did you tell him that story?
I'm really afraid to talk to him. I did. And then some years later, I was in New York and I was supposed to have a cup of coffee with him and at a hotel. And there were two hotels by the same name and I went to the wrong one and
I wound up
standing them up. And so I was absolutely mortified.
Right.
And, you know, sent emails with abject apologies and he was great about it. but it's funny the way that my sort of encounters with him in person have punctuated the different moods of my writing life. But I feel honored that I was finally able to speak to him.
I want to ask about the fortune cookie.
Get to know him.
I want to ask about the fortune cookie. Have you done things like that before? Have you often sometimes out of desperation looked for, you know, invented, you know, signs or something and wanted something to, you know, be that little signpost, say, yes, I'm on the right track. Does that happen to you a lot still? Or was that just the one time?
Yeah, sure. I think every time I have a book out there, I'm looking for an answer, or if I'm waiting for a review. And so I'm, you know, Googling the free I Ching reading online. though, of course, if you get the answer you want, you don't believe it. And if you get the answer you don't want, you just, you know, you do it again.
Right.
So, again, not an exercise in mental health. But I think, too, as writers, we are often looking at science because there's so much a rejection along the way and so much waiting that we can get a little superstitious. So like if I, you know, avoiding black cats when I'm walking the dog and while I have a book on submission.
I've become convinced that I am that the only way that I am psychic is when I have something on submission. And because usually about 3 days before I get the rejection letter, I have like one of those horrible, no good, nasty, crappy days. You know, I wake up in a bad mood. Everything's awful. You know, I stub my toe coming out of the shower and I bang my head on the car door getting in, you know, and everybody's on my nerves. And then 3 days later, oh, that's why they sent the rejection letter.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think baseball players and writers are the most superstitious professions I know of. And then the other funny thing about writing is what passes for good news is kind of pathetic sometimes. So once I entered a contest and I didn't win, but I placed well enough that I received a prize, and the prize was that I could enter the same competition the next year for free. And at first I was like, oh, that's great. And then I thought, no, what passes for good news is pathetic here.
Yeah.
Because the other implication would be is that I would still have this piece and be trying to win this contest the next year. And I do, you know, so often too, we get excited, like, oh, handwritten, personalized rejection,
right.
Which is nice. And I tell my students, that's good. Actually, editors don't have time. They don't do that if they don't mean it.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's nothing. It's still a rejection. So
right.
It's something you want to be caught celebrating.
Right.
You can be pleased that it's a sign that you're working in the right direction, but you're not supposed to crack open a beer.
Right. Yeah, I think the same thing that same approach should be taken with even, you know, sort of obvious sort of awards or semi-awards, you know, just to keep things level so you don't get too ahead of yourself or think it's too important, when really it's sometimes just one person in a contest that is the reason you... Because I submitted a short story to the Atlantic Monthly as a student writing competition my first year mm-hmm. in graduate school and received an honorable mention from it.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, and I was like, oh, that's such a big deal. And Keith Abbott at Naropa goes, well, you know, don't put too much stock in that. I mean, it's a committee. So there was probably one guy there who liked your story and held that as leverage and said, well, I'll help you get your guy the first place vote if you give my guy an honorable mention. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, he didn't need to tell you that.
Yeah, but it kept my ego in check, which was important.
Yeah, I guess that's good. And then you say, hey, at least one guy liked it.
At least one guy liked it. I would like to know who that one guy was. Find out where they're working now and just send them everything.
Yeah, if they want to buy a book. Yeah, and I think that's another thing I tell my students too, is sometimes is you have to decide how many people you're writing for.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer should be at least one other person besides yourself, and
right.
and somewhere less than probably, you know, 2 million people. And, you know, you can't write for everybody,
mm-hmm.
even wildly popular writers. Don't write for everybody. So I think that's good. So you found your guy.
Yeah. I need to keep that in mind, though, because sometimes I lose track of it and end up going back to that sense of competition again and finding someone that I can, you know, direct some anger at and write against that.
Yeah. And I think comparison and jealousy are just... It's too dangerous in writing.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way to be happy if you do much of that in writing. And so,
So how soon after graduate school did you end up selling Hunger?
13 years.
Wow.
So I wrote 2 other novels in that time. And had a kid and worked full time and did various other things. So I kept writing. I wrote a really bad novel.
Who doesn't write a really bad novel?
The premise of which that Huey Long might still be alive. And then I wrote a pretty good novel. Flawed, but mm-hmm. better than anything I'd written before. And I got an agent for it. And he was unable to sell it. He came close at a few places, but after he stopped trying, he wrote me every 6 months mm-hmm. and said, you have something for me, you have something for me. He was particularly interested in Louisiana, although he's from New York. Mm-hmm. And so he was hoping I would write the great Louisiana novel. And so finally one day I wrote to him and I said, I finished a book, I sent it to you. And he said, oh, great. What's it about and how long is it? Mm-hmm. And I said, it's about the siege of Leningrad and it's about 120 pages long. And he said, what the fuck is the matter with you?
And, that phrase exactly?
Yeah, pretty much. I believe that's a direct quote. And I don't think the FCC monitors podcast, right? Again, I tried not to cry, but I was working at Princeton University Press, and so I went over at lunchtime, and I went to the gym, and I pounded my way on the Stairmaster, you know, weeping. Mm-hmm. And then I went back, and there was a message, and he said, I'm sorry, I'm going to read it with an open mind. And then he called back about a week later and said, I like it. I think I can sell it. And he did.
Nice.
And so I think he was initially disappointed that it wasn't the great Louisiana novel. But he sold it and it, you know, it changed my life.
Yeah. So you've been with Unbridled and Fred Ramey since the beginning.
No, actually, Little Brown bought Hunger. Unbridled put it back into print for me. So now if you buy Hunger with the beautiful Apple cover, mm-hmm. it's Unbridled because they I sold them the rights after the Little Brown run.
Oh,
but it was originally published by Little Brown in the United States and some other publishers overseas. And then I went to Unbridled with my second novel, The Natural History of Cypress Parish, and I had already sold my third novel to mm-hmm. a different publisher by chance, and so they came out the same year. But then I've stayed with Unbridled ever since. They put Hunger back in print for me and published my fourth and then my fifth book, and I love them.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's great. I've had the best of both worlds. I got mm-hmm. to publish, you know, with a larger house and a smaller house and see the advantages and disadvantages of both. And
right.
I've been lucky to work with great editors and many, you know, including at Little Brown. But Fred Ramey is the best editor I've ever worked with, hands down.
Yeah. He's the only editor I've worked with, but I was... I guess, you know, kind of like your first love, he was the first person, you know, that I'd never met before who got it, you know, and understood what I was trying to do and didn't send me back a letter, you know, basically telling me, well, we want this to turn into like the Da Vinci Code, but in Bosnia. Right. You know, so yeah, I've always been very impressed with, and you know, having talked to him, stuff like that, with his depth of knowledge and his passion for it.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
And they just have a commitment to literature that is rare. And I will say that the book industry is filled with people who love good books. I mean, mm-hmm. it's why they're in the business. But the marketing forces at play and the kinds of financial pressures,
right.
even the deepest book lovers in publishing are under, you know, lead to some negative outcomes, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Too many.
It's a rough business.
Too many presses, I think, have been sucked up into the big five, and
yeah.
it really disrupts the model.
Yeah, and I worry, too, because the mid-list writer has now become pejorative. That used to be not such a bad thing to be. Mm-hmm. You know, and it goes back to what I said, as you sort of decide how many people you're writing for, and I worry now that it's not just that a book needs to make money, which of course they need their books to make money, but that they would prefer to publish a few books that make a lot of money.
Right.
And so it's the Hollywood blockbuster versus the modestly successful film.
Right.
And again, there are lots of exceptions to that. And I know that editors at those big houses are working under tremendous financial pressures
right.
on themselves. But I don't think it's good for the literary marketplace.
No, it's drive. I think it's also driving it a lot towards serialization. It's like if I wanted to constantly always be bombarded with, you know, serialized stories, I'd watch TV, you know, or read comic books, and rather than individual, you know, works of literary art.
Mm-hmm. And I also know the shrinking review space for books too.
Yeah.
I mean, causes, you know, a few books to get a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now the wonderful things, you know, there are some terrific things going on in publishing too, and there has been a real heterogeneization due to book bloggers. So lots
right.
of books are getting wonderful online attention, and different kinds of books are finding different kinds of readers. And I think that's great, but that's generally happening online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And independent bookstores. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the big independent bookstore in your neighborhood?
Sadly, Columbia, South Carolina no longer has an independent bookstore. We had a great place called the Happy Bookseller. And when the people decided to get out of the business, the store didn't go under, but they, for several reasons, decided to get out of the business, and they couldn't find anyone to take it over.
Huh.
There's a rumor going around town that a couple is going to open an independent bookstore in town. And so we're all cheering for it and
right.
Doing everything we can to encourage them to go forward with that. So we have a couple of Barnes and Nobles, and that's it. So I tend to shop at indie bookstores when I travel. I get my to-read list and bring it with me on the road and try to pick up books wherever I am. Luckily, I've been on book tour a lot now, so I have been getting around and going to stores. But we also... Spartanburg has a great independent bookstore called Hub City, and Athens, Georgia has Avid Books, and Malaprops up in Asheville are all in striking range for me. So Julia Liz Elliott, who has a new novel out with Tin House, lives in Columbia too, and we're going to have a launch party in about 2 weeks, and Hub City Books is going to come down to handle the book sale for us because we wanted that an indie to get that business. And so I'm excited that they're going to do that.
So where are you going? Where are you going to hit on the tour? Do you know yet, or is it?
Yeah, I'm doing several book festivals, so I've already been to the Decatur Book Festival, and I just flew back yesterday from Fall for the Book, and next week I'm going to the Southern Book Festival in Nashville, and I'll be at Words and Music Book Festival in New Orleans for Halloween weekend, which is great. I'm really excited to be in New Orleans for Halloween. And then I am also visiting some bookstores, including Fiction Addiction in Greenville, South Carolina, and Scuppernog Books up in Greensboro, North Carolina, and a few other places. So I'm teaching this semester, so I'm sort of out and back, rather than being on the road the whole time, which is great, because with a Natural History of Cypress Parish, I was on the road for 3.5 weeks. I didn't come home, and I was feral by the time I got home. It was a little too long to be out on the road alone.
Right.
So I like this better, and my dogs are much happier. So I go out for a few days, come home, go out, come home.
Wow. So what's it like having an agent?
Having an agent is great. I've had a couple of different agents. I love the agent I have now. I think one of the things I like about it, and I was going to say even though, but maybe even especially because I have such a good relationship with my editor, it is nice to have someone in the picture as an advocate who handles questions about money,
right,
and things like that, that the writer and the editor might not want to discuss one-on-one,
mm-hmm.
You know, who just keeps our relationship pure and about the work. So it's really nice to have an agent on that side of things.
Right.
You're agent shopping now, right?
Yeah. The query letter is probably the most difficult thing in the world for me to write.
Yeah, it's a tough genre. And the internet helps a lot. I remember my first agent, I got that book, Jeff Herman's Guide to Literary Agents, and I went through and I wrote down 25 names and addresses, and I sent out the query letter to those 25 people,
right,
and got mostly no's and varying other responses. But the agent I got, I saw that he liked literary fiction and mysteries set in Louisiana. So I thought we might have a connection. And
right,
indeed, that is the agent who wound up representing me and selling my first novel.
Cool.
But we later parted ways. And right now, my agent is Tara Chalberg.
Mm-hmm.
She was with Susan Gollum, but has gone out on her own, has an agency called Chalberg and Sussman. And I like her a lot. Increasingly, agents are acting as editors,
mm-hmm.
too. I've seen this in other friends who are writers. A lot of the kind of developmental editing that happens now is happening between the agent and the writer before the book is even submitted.
Yeah.
And editors are doing less of that work, especially at the big houses.
Right,
you know, they're
right,
really looking for books that are very close to camera ready or certainly ready for their last copy of it.
Right. Yeah, because I got to get those out relatively fast and turn it around.
Yeah.
Good.
And there's some bad agents out there. I've heard some horror stories.
Yeah.
And I think agents, too, are, you know, they're trying to figure out their place in the changing literary marketplace, too.
Right. I think what the hardest part about it is that, you know, usually when you're querying an agent, you're doing it with just one book, but you're trying to use that one book to convince them that you have this long arc of a career.
Yeah.
And, you know, invest in me as a person, as a developing, growing writer who, if you ask, will say, I'm not half as good as I want to be, but you're going to have to believe that based on what it is I just turned out.
Yeah, and I think you really want somebody who does want to work with you across your whole career. I think too many writers, agents, and editors are having one-book relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I do really like about Unbridled is working with the same editor across several books.
Right.
But that's becoming increasingly less common.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Well, good luck.
Thanks. We've been at it for about an hour, and there's usually one question towards the end that I kind of like to throw out to everyone, and then we'll wrap it up here. And it kind of has to do with, you know, the literary ecology, our environment, our habit, our ecosystem. And, you know, every year the National Endowment for the Arts comes out with that study, you know, and they tell us about how literary reading is declining. And then Amazon comes at us and says, you know, actually reading numbers are going up. Look at all these sales that we've got and whatever. And what I tend to see from that is that it tends to be for genre stuff, serialized stuff. And at the same time, they are right that that number and that percentage for reading of literature is declining, but the reading of serialized, you know, subgenres is booming. And so what I'm kind of curious about is, what do other writers think that we can or should be doing to kind of be good stewards of the literary landscape? What can we do to draw people back towards those singular pieces of literary art?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think whenever I write challenges, it's scary to me. I read one survey that 1 in 4 American adults claims to be writing a book, which is more than the percentage of Americans who read a book
right.
each year. Now, a lot
probably
of
why it's harder to find an agent.
Yeah. And a lot of those books will never be finished or see the light of the day. And a lot of them may be, you know, hello.
Hi. Skype cut us
off.
Hi.
I could still hear you, but
yeah, I don't know what the deal was.
Am I back?
Yep, you're back.
Anyway, I'm glad to be back. Yeah. So I think I was saying that I think it's, you know, it's not a sustainable ecology if we have more people writing books than reading them each year.
Right.
You know, there's no one to read all of the books that are being written. And I see in my students too, even the English majors who are taking my creative writing class now, they're reading large amounts of genre fiction, especially fantasy, dystopian YA fantasy and other
right.
kinds. And often that's what they're wanting to write as well. And I think it's great if they're also reading works of literature, but I think if you're reading only genre fiction, you know, you get addicted to junk food, right?
Right.
And I have friends who read all kinds. They read literary fiction, and then they read, you know, Norwegian thrillers as brain candy. And I think that's great as long as people still are. And I think we look at the case of poetry, we see now it feels like not much poetry is being read except by other poets.
Right.
And that's still a vibrant culture. And a lot of really interesting things are going on in poetry, and poets are also really wonderful about reading each other's work. And really kind of engaging in this, and not collaborative poetry, but a collaborative culture of poetry.
Right.
And that's one model for literary fiction is, you know, to read each other and support it. And I think that's happening at least to some degree. But I think it's also important to get people to read works of art.
Right.
What can we do? I don't know. Some people hold up prizes as one way to get attention for particular books, and that may be. I run a literary series here called The Open Book, where I bring in 5 writers each spring. And one of the point of the format is to get people to actually read the books. And so we read a book together. I or a colleague of mine gives a talk on that book on the Monday, and then on the Wednesday, the writer comes in and talks about the book. So those kinds of programs can bring people to literary fiction, you know, community reads and one book programs.
Right.
On the other hand, I hate for us all to be reading the same few books.
right.
Yeah. But I think... Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know.
No, it's I'm not sure. Everybody's got slightly different takes on it when I ask the question, but I think it's important just to ask the question, maybe to start a conversation about it, which kind of, you know, branches back to my my chosen literary lineage, which is going through Naropa University and Anne Waldman and Allen Ginsberg and all these guys, which is about the, you know, this kind of Buddhist mindfulness approach to writing, being engaged with the world and the society and the culture around you through your work. And I think part of that you know, for me is asking that question. You know, if I want to do this as a calling or as a vocation or even potentially hope to, you know, make it a significant part of my life, I need an audience. What do I do to build that audience?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think it's wonderful that you're engaging in, you know, to use a word that's popular right now, literary citizenship. And I do feel like writers have a responsibility to, if not be literary citizens, you know, participate and help create a culture of reading, be supportive of other writers. But we also need readers who aren't writers. And one of my favorite things is when someone talks to me, I'm like, are you a writer? And they say, I'm just a reader. It's like, just a reader. No such thing. It's the very best thing to be. And I get disturbed when I have students who write but don't read.
That's frightening.
That's not sustainable for you as a writer or for the literary culture. But then I think as writers too, we have to find ways also. I do think it's important for literary writers to, some of us anyway, to reclaim the pleasures of plot, as they say.
Yes.
I don't think that means that you should try to pander or compete with the Hunger Games. I mean, I'm absolutely comfortable that I am writing for fewer people than Stephen King or J.K. Rowling is writing for. But I also think maybe I can write for a few more people by strengthening the plot in the books that I write, by trying to write something that is engaging to people as well as provocative. That's one thing we can do. And then online spaces have created a lot of space too. And there's some wonderful people out there promoting books, and the people at Book Riot, for instance, to name just one. But I'm curious, what other ideas have you got from asking this question?
Well, I think a lot of it, I think the biggest one is the idea that, you know, a friend of mine from graduate school, Jen Zukowski, is she reads widely, but her favorite thing to write, what she likes to write, is sort of fantasy fiction. And she's a very militant and stand-up person that fantasy work can be just as literarily significant as, you know, Hemingway and whatever. It just depends on how dedicated that writer is to avoiding, you know, the easy cliche and the easy trope and, you know, relying on, you know, the crutches and the shortcuts that genre sometimes allows, you know, and avoiding formula. Formula is so easy with things like mystery and sci-fi and stuff like that. You plug in the aliens in the right spot and do whatever, and you have your cardboard stereotypical, you know, characters. And they just have to serve that function of the next explosion in the story. You know, and they stick pretty much to Freytag's triangle every time, and that's it. And yeah, I think we used to say, you know, plot happens, kind of like shit. And, you know, it's so we always kind of, there are different ways to, I guess, as they say, you know, chase the main character up a tree and surround it with dogs and see how they get down. There's different ways. That's the basics of any plot, you know, I guess. You put someone in jeopardy. Well, there doesn't have to be a gun involved. There doesn't have to be explosions. There, you could even do that without people leaving a room. And it all depends on where you're putting, I guess, the camera, so to speak, of the narrator. You know, so we should focus more on, I think that's the big thing. The first rule is to be entertaining. I presented that to a writer who teaches at the MFA program here in Wichita State. And he's like, no, the first rule is to be interesting. And I went, aren't those the same thing?
Yeah, I know. And there are, and I'm one of those writers who will read for language. I will be intrigued and entertained by a book because the language is interesting. But I also know that most readers are not like that. And I don't see any reason why you can't have really interesting language and also do something else.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the hard part. That's something I keep trying to figure out.
Yeah. And then it's also not like you can just sit down and say, what's the very best, most entertaining book I can write? You know, we also, mm-hmm. you know, we can write the books that we can write, you know, right. based on who we are and what we're interested in and what our experiences are. But I do think about the reader a lot more than I used to when I'm writing, and I think particularly with relationship to plot.
Yeah.
Because we do read books to find out what happened, you know.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
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 So something better happen.
Yeah.
Good luck with the lower quarter. I think this will be great.
Thank
You've been
you
getting
much.
Some good reviews, haven't you?
Yes, yeah, so far so good. So that's always a relief.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I've been pleased that it's been noticed a little and found some readers who have enjoyed it.
Well, I'm gonna press stop on the record, but don't go away.
Okay.
We'll talk for a little bit after that. So thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, it's been delightful. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Bye. All right, so there you have it, my conversation with Elise Blackwell. I hope you enjoyed it. We certainly had a good time. And you should go out and pick up her book, The Lower Quarter, and give it a read and enjoy it because it's good. And that's all I got. There are no plans for another interview right away, although I'm working the corners, the edges, so we'll see what happens. There, of course, will be another shop talk at the beginning of November. So if all else fails, I'll see you at the beginning of November. So have a good night. I'll see you soon. Back again. Don't